This is the time set for oral argument in two cases this afternoon. The first, is Morrow Thomas versus State of Nevada, case number 77345. As you can see, Justice Stiglitz and Justice Silver are not physically present in the courthouse. Justice Stiglitz is viewing and participating in the oral argument online. Justice Silver is out of town and unavailable for this conference, but she will be participating in the disposition and listening to the oral argument prior to the court voting on this case. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir. May I remove my mask?
Yes, you may.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Joanne Diamond. I represent the appellant, Marlo Thomas, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Okay. Today, I'd like to talk about why Thomas should be granted a new trial because he was deprived of his right to a fair and impartial jury. First, at the penalty retrial jurors learned off the record that he had been previously sentenced to death by another jury. And second, a juror at his guilt phase trial Joseph Hannigan concealed his bias against Thomas during voir dire. Beginning with the penalty retrial jurors, five penalty retrial jurors, including the foreperson, provided declarations in these post-conviction proceedings stating they learned during the penalty retrial that Thomas had been previously sentenced to death by another jury. But the state agrees that information was not disclosed on the record. The jurors' receipt of this prejudicial, extraneous information warrants a new trial. Initially, I would submit that it is structural error because it biased the jurors against him, and the presence of a biased adjudicator is structural error. But even if this court considered a harmless error analysis, this court's opinion in Mayer makes clear that when jurors learn of prejudicial, extraneous information about the defendant, there's a reasonable probability that that affected the verdict and a new trial is warranted. I would submit.
Well, how did they find out then?
That's
and
the question.
Did they actually find out, or did they just find out subsequently and years later memories are affected?
Well, Your Honor, they were very clear in their declarations that they learned during the trial. And some jurors say they heard it from the judge. Some said they heard it from one of the attorneys, but they were very clear they heard it during the trial, and it's not on the record.
So if the record shows that it didn't happen by the judge or the attorneys, aren't their declarations belied by the record?
No, Your Honor, because I would submit that it's not beyond the realm of probability that people overhear things. Impropriety does happen. We don't know what may have been said in front of the jurors or improperly mentioned to the jurors by one of the attorneys, even by the trial court. And at the very least, the way to flesh this issue out would have been to have an evidentiary hearing where these questions could have been explored. But the district court denied an evidentiary hearing, and she denied it on an improper basis. The district court here used this court's opinion in Echavarria to say that the juror declarations were inadmissible under NRS 50.0652. But that prohibits juror declarations and testimony concerning thought processes involved in deliberations. These declarations include some of that, but materially have important objective facts that state they learned this information. And this court's opinion in Mayer was clear that when juror misconduct alleged involves jurors' receipt of prejudicial extraneous information, objective facts that they received that information are admissible. So the district court simply erred in not holding an evidentiary hearing because she found that the declarations were inadmissible when this court's case law is clear that they were admissible.
Thank you.
I'd like to turn to the presence of Joseph Hannigan on Thomas's guilt phase jury.
Who's that? Sorry, say again.
His name is Joseph Hannigan, H-A-N-N-I-G-A-N. Now, Mr. Hannigan was asked two critical questions on voir dire that he failed to answer honestly. And if he had answered those questions honestly, it would have provided the basis for a valid challenge for cause. The trial court asked Mr. Hannigan if he had ever been the victim of a crime. And they asked...
No, I'm struggling with how you present that issue to us on this, your client's appeal from the denial of his third, of a post-conviction as to a penalty phase hearing. And you're going back to the original trial with this. So I think you need to explain to me, at least, how you think that's in play at this late stage of these proceedings.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, initially, I would submit that when you have this kind of juror misconduct, where it's willful concealment en voir dire, that's the type of issue that should be permitted to be raised within a reasonable time of discovery, because it's pretty analogous to a Brady claim. You expect certain people involved in the court processes, jurors, prosecutors, to follow their oaths, to be honest. And Juror Hannigan was not honest, and that's why this is being brought up now. So I would submit that we raised it in a reasonable time. It shouldn't be defaulted. In addition to that, there's reasons why we have cases like Priority is one that I would say is very on fours with Mr. Hannigan's situation and Mayer. And when you have that kind of juror issue, it must be someone's obligation to raise it. There was nothing on the record to give anyone any indication that this issue with Juror Hannigan existed.
So your position is something like this could come up at any time. If 25 years after the trial, someone does some investigation, finds out there was a misrepresentation, that would then be a timely habeas claim.
I mean, Your Honor, I would say in the same way that it would work with a Brady claim, although now is not, that's not the situation that we're dealing with. We timely raised it when we investigated this. And I would say that if these kinds of constitutional issues exist, someone is responsible for bringing them to the court's attention. So either first state post-conviction counsel, which in this case would have been David Sheik, and I'll talk a little more about why David Sheik's ineffectiveness is still live right now, it's not defaulted, or we can bring it now. Because otherwise, these issues never get raised. And this man had a biased juror on a murder trial. So if David Sheik was required to raise it, because he was... post-conviction counsel are required to investigate potential constitutional claims. We know juror issues are potential constitutional claims, and this court has issued opinions showing that. That means then either post-conviction counsel should interview jurors to look for these claims, and then if they don't, we can raise their ineffectiveness. If that's not the case, then it should be able to be timely raised. So let me talk about what I think the court is interested in, is why the issues involving David Sheik as guilt phase post-conviction counsel are timely, and therefore any guilt phase errors are timely. So the post-conviction proceedings in this case ended in October 2016. Under RIPO, we had 1 year to file a petition under Crump raising ineffective assistance of prior post-conviction counsel, which we did. Now the state says the issues concerning David Sheik as post-conviction counsel should have been raised by Brett Whipple, who was post-conviction counsel from the penalty retrial, and that they should have been raised within 1 year of this court's denial of Thomas's direct appeal from the penalty retrial. That is not what this court said in RIPO. In RIPO, this court said that a post-conviction counsel claim is timely if it's within 1 year of the end of the post-conviction proceedings, and that's because post-conviction counsel claims become right at the end of post-conviction proceedings. The date that the state picked was very specific to Thomas, because in Thomas, during those post-conviction proceedings after the guilt trial, this court sent his case back for a penalty retrial. And David Sheik stayed on as counsel. And he stayed on as counsel through the end of the direct appeal from the penalty retrial. If, under a strict reading of RIPO, the allegations against David Sheik should have been raised by March 2005, because that is 1 year from the denial of the post-conviction following the guilt phase. But Sheik still represented Thomas, and he represented him through the penalty retrial. And this court explained in Nika why requiring someone to both attack their counsel's performance at the same time that that counsel is representing them in another matter is unworkable for several reasons. One, it requires counsel and the petitioner to be at odds with each other, because in this instance, Thomas would be trusting David Sheik to fight for his life in a penalty retrial while saying, you did not do right by me in the guilt phase post-conviction proceedings. Even if separate counsel were appointed, which they weren't, and if they should have been, that is an impediment external to the defense that does not bind Thomas to this waiver.
Well, if he had filed the petition at that time alleging ineffectiveness of first post-conviction counsel, then perhaps counsel would have been appointed, but it wasn't filed.
So under the 8th Judicial District local rules, the only way that would have been filed is if Thomas had done it, because Sheik wasn't going to file it on himself.
Right.
And if Thomas had done that, it would not have been filed, because the 8th Judicial District rules won't accept a filing from a petitioner that is represented by counsel. They will reject that filing. And he had counsel. He had Sheik. So there was no way for Thomas to get counsel, and Sheik couldn't raise ineffectiveness on himself. So that is why the state have picked a date that is divorced from RICO, because it gets around this problem that the court identified in NECA. And if it was due in March 2005, as an initial matter, as I've stated, the fact that Thomas didn't get outside counsel, that Sheik didn't do something to make this happen, means that Thomas didn't waive those claims because he had counsel and he couldn't advocate for himself. But it also causes the kind of problems that this court identified in Johnson. So in Johnson, we have a very similar case, but there he got penalty relief on direct appeal. And he waited until the direct appeal from the penalty retrial was over to file an initial post-conviction petition, raising issues from both the guilt and the penalty retrial. And the state there, as here, said that's untimely. He should have filed it from the first direct appeal from the guilt trial. And this court said no, that that is complicated, that is unworkable, and that is, you know, to just quote this court, and I think this is equally applicable here, accepting the state's position would introduce the type of confusion and inefficiency the current post-conviction scheme was enacted to avoid. This court passed RICO to make things simple. Things were complicated before RICO, and this court wanted everybody to be on the same page. This is when a post-conviction petition is timely. Now, a strict reading of RICO in this case isn't workable. So I would submit that when you have, whenever you get the first post-conviction proceedings are finished, and in this case it was when the post-conviction proceedings from the penalty retrial were finished, you have 1 year under RICO to file a crump petition. Then it doesn't matter what else happens in the first post-conviction proceedings, because Thomas could have got penalty relief again. And then you've got, at what point are people crump counsel? At what point are people first post-conviction counsel? If we say the post-conviction proceedings are one post-conviction proceeding, and if you're in a situation like Thomas and you get penalty relief, those ineffective assistance of guilt post-conviction counsel claims, they don't go anywhere. They're on hold until the first post-conviction proceeding is over, which is when the penalty retrial post-conviction is over. Then you have 1 year to timely file crump claims. And that's what Thomas did here. So if David Sheik was required to raise and investigate Juror Hannigan's bias, then that claim is not defaulted, because we've alleged Sheik was ineffective for not doing so. And Your Honor, Juror Hannigan, and it's explained in detail in the briefs, had a very specific, unpleasant experience with a convicted murderer. This man, who he gave a chance to, took over his business and ran a RICO operation through it, caused Juror Hannigan to flee for his life with his wife to Las Vegas. His wife had to testify against this organization just 2 years before the trial. And then when Hannigan was asked if he'd been the victim of a crime or closely associated with anyone that had been arrested for a crime, he did not disclose his connection. And he didn't do that because he didn't hear the question. He answered other questions, gave other answers to those questions. He didn't say, I forgot. He said, I was not trying to think about it, because he was terrified of this organization, even 20 years later, when my investigator went there. In Briordi, this court was clear that these are not the kind of things that jurors can make a decision not to disclose. And Juror Hannigan's experience with that convicted murderer is far too close, and it requires a finding of implied bias because he should never have been seated on a murder trial.
Your time's about to run.
And I will reserve for rebuttal if there are no additional questions.
May it please the court, John Nyman on behalf of Respondent, State of Nevada. In the limited time that I have, I'm going to focus on just two issues. The first is why the district court properly found that there was no good cause to overcome the procedural time bars. And the second is why the district court properly dismissed most of the claims pursuant to latches. This, as you pointed out, Justice Pickering, is the third petition. It's procedurally barred as to guilt-based claims. It's procedurally barred as to penalty retrial claims. The only claims that were live here were claims that Brett Whipple was deficient in first habeas from the penalty retrial. This court affirmed the guilt phase of this trial in 1999. Mr. Sheik filed a first post-conviction proceeding. The denial was affirmed in 2004, but it was sent back for another penalty retrial. So any second petition related to the guilt phase was due by 2005. That was 1 year after remitter issued for this court. Justice Kadish, as you pointed out, there was no petition filed. There was no request even for counsel. There was no attempt to raise claims by Mr. Sheik. And nobody could have been deficient for doing that because that person would have been second post-conviction counsel, to which there is no entitlement to counsel, and therefore no entitlement to the effective assistance of counsel.
How do you respond to counsel's response to my question that if he had tried to file it on his own, it would have been rejected because he had counsel of record, Mr. Sheik, at the time, and Mr. Sheik wouldn't file it because he's the one being accused of being ineffective?
So I suppose there's two responses to that. The first, I think, is that in practice, at least from what I've seen, it's not the case that the district court routinely and completely rejects any filing from a defendant. And the second is that he wasn't represented by Mr. Sheik for the purposes of a second habeas proceeding. He might have been represented for the purposes of penalty retrial. He continued to be represented for the purposes of an appeal from the denial of that. But he was not represented for a second habeas proceeding. Nor could he have been. Mr. Sheik couldn't have asserted his own effectiveness. And so even if Mr. Sheik had filed a petition on the petitioner's behalf, somebody else would have had to have been appointed. Now, the penalty retrial was affirmed in 2008. Claims related to Mr. Sheik's ineffectiveness as far as the penalty retrial goes were due by 2009. And Mr. Whipple, with the assistance of the federal public defenders, filed that petition in 2008. It was denied. That denial was affirmed here in 2016. So by the time the third petition came around, by 2017, the only claims that could be raised were deficient performance of Mr. Whipple in that first petition from the penalty retrial. Now, what I would ask this court to please do is go back and review the 2017 petition that was initially filed, because the claims as they're being presented on appeal are in broad strokes the same, but the good cause allegations are not the same as what was presented in 2017. Looking at the appellant's appendix, I'm looking at 655 to 56. This is the good cause section of the 2017 petition. There's passing references to unspecified, quote, post-conviction counsel, but there'd been several post-conviction counsel by that point. There was one claim targeted at, quote, second post-conviction counsel, which presumably was Mr. Whipple. He was the only one in that position, and that was assertedly claim two. However, if the court then goes and reviews claim two, or in fact any other claim in that petition, you'll find that at no point was the ineffective assistance of Mr. Whipple alleged as good cause. So even though that was perhaps facially targeted at Mr. Whipple, that was not the argument that was actually presented in the petition. Our response to the petition explains that. We also argue that the claims were meritless, just in case those passing references did somehow target a claim specific to Mr. Whipple. And in the response. So we filed a response to the petition. We also included a motion to dismiss pursuant to latches. And I'll talk about latches in a minute. But in the response to our motion to dismiss, the reply to our petition response, there's new arguments that begin to get raised and begin to get targeted at Mr. Whipple. Now, this was all filed, the third petition was filed, I believe, on the day 1 year after remitter issued. So it was timely as to claims of Mr. Whipple, but those claims weren't made. And by the time this reply is made, you're past the 1 year period anyway. Now, the second post-conviction, there's an argument here that Mr. Sheik's ineffectiveness constitutes good cause for the guilt phase claims. That's at Appellant's Appendix 75, 48 to 51. There was that argument that we just talked about, Justice Kadish, that second post-conviction counsel should have been appointed, but there is no requirement to appoint second post-conviction counsel, even in a capital case. There was also an argument that Mr. Whipple was ineffective for not challenging Mr. Sheik as regards the guilt phase. But by the time that Mr. Whipple got the petition in 2008 and guilt phase claims had to be raised in 2005, they were already time barred. Mr. Whipple couldn't have raised guilt phase claims. He could only raise retrial claims. The reply argues that Mr. Whipple's ineffectiveness constitutes good cause for the first time. That's Appellant's Appendix 75, 59 to 64. But those were new arguments that were not raised in the initial 2017 petition. And so we had two responses to that. The first is that it's inappropriate to raise new allegations of good cause for the first time in a reply to a petition. Those have to be presented in the initial petition so that everybody knows what they have to respond to, everybody's on the same page arguing about the same thing, and the argument doesn't shift. The second was that those were untimely by that point because, again, it was after 1 year from remitter of Mr. Whipple's, this court's affirmance of the dismissal of Mr. Whipple's petition, or denial of Mr. Whipple's petition.
Sorry, the point of alleging, as you suggest, ineffective assistance of Mr. Whipple in the prior petition would be to be able to say he was ineffective for not raising ineffective assistance claims of prior counsel.
Correct, yes. To provide good cause to raise what would otherwise be untimely claims, correct.
Right. So then to succeed on those claims, they would have to establish that Mr. Whipple was ineffective for raising certain claims of ineffectiveness as to Mr. Sheik, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
As
to Mr. Whipple for not raising claims against Mr. Sheik, which
right.
would have been meritorious had they been presented at
right.
the penalty retrial.
Right. And sorry, just before we go on,
sure.
At that second penalty hearing where Mr. Sheik represented Mr. Thomas, was Mr. or now Judge Albrecht also counsel at that time?
I don't believe so, but I'm not for sure on that.
Okay.
I believe that he was just part of the initial trial. I could be wrong on that, though. I don't recall.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. The second thing that we pointed out, and I should say our response pointing out what I mostly was just saying is that Appellant's Appendix 85, 45 to 60. The second thing that we pointed out was that in 2008, when prior to Brett Whipple even filing his petition, I think there was actually another counsel just prior to Mr. Whipple, but didn't really do anything substantive. It was Mr. Whipple's petition for all intents and purposes. But in 2008, the district court appointed the federal public defenders to assist Mr. Whipple in drafting that petition. And that's at our argument, Appellant's Appendix 85-54. The district court's order is at Appellant's Appendix 69-85 to 86. There was no recognition, much less explanation, about how Mr. Whipple was deficient for failing to investigate a variety of things when he was presumably being assisted by the federal public defenders. And of course, now they're at the third petition, not trying to talk about whether they were or were not themselves deficient. It becomes quite confusing and quite a morass. And to be fair to the district court didn't necessarily seem to put any particular weight on that, didn't mention it in the order. But it is a fact that goes to whether Mr. Whipple was, whether Mr. Whipple was actually deficient or not.
But you do concede in your briefs that that the current petition can raise claims that Mr. Whipple was ineffective in not asserting certain claims to do with Mr. Sheik in the penalty phase on the second penalty hearing, correct?
Could have done so if raised in the 2017 petition, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, those were potentially timely when the initial petition was filed, but those claims weren't in that petition. They didn't show up until the reply much later.
What about the additional, I mean, as I understand it, it's complicated, it but is. There's a lot of social background and upbringing of Mr. Thomas in mitigation that is argued, although I haven't traced it through the petition, that Mr. Sheik in the second penalty hearing should have raised and that Mr. Whipple should have faulted Mr. Sheik for not raising as ineffective.
So,
do you follow what I'm asking?
I do, and as Justice Kadish pointed out before, there is potentially a way to raise that claim. And I would submit that the way we'll raise that claim is to say, look, Mr. Whipple was deficient when he attacked Mr. Sheik because Mr. Whipple should have challenged that Mr. Sheik didn't present all this information. And of course, Mr. Sheik should have presented all of that information. And at least the allegation would go, had that information been presented, it would have led to a verdict other than death in the second penalty retrial. So you have to show the deficient performance all the way down to prejudice of a new verdict. But nothing even remotely close to that was in the 2017.
And then you have to factor in our 2016 decision saying it wasn't ineffective of Mr. Sheik not to have put in additional evidence.
Correct. I mean, you know, that was part of the decision that affirmed the denial of Mr. Whipple's petition.
Right.
And yeah. So I think that the general allegation is, well, if all this other stuff had come in, then this court would have come to a different decision. And maybe yes, maybe no, but that wasn't a claim that was presented.
So isn't the claims being raised in this petition, at least the ones we're talking about as to Mr. Sheik's performance in the second penalty phase, that those are actually the claims. The claims now are that, at least that I'm talking about, are that Mr. Sheik was ineffective in the second penalty phase hearing by not presenting X, Y, and Z, whatever that is.
Sure.
The fact of, or allegation of Mr. Whipple's ineffectiveness is good cause to excuse the procedural defaults that would otherwise prevent now raising ineffectiveness of
Correct.
Mr. Sheik, right? So the claims themselves are Mr. Sheik was ineffective in X, Y, and Z ways. And then in response to alleged untimely and successive petitions, then it's no, we have good cause for raising them now because Mr. Whipple ineffectively either didn't raise them or didn't raise them sufficiently.
Correct. That kind of claim would provide that kind of good cause. But again, that kind of claim wasn't made here, especially in the 2017 petition.
And so, but your argument is that in the petition itself, though, when asked about procedural defaults and good cause that would excuse them, that they didn't raise that the good cause that would excuse it is Mr. Whipple's ineffectiveness?
Well, to some extent, but you, my opinion, you would have to do more than just say, Mr. Whipple was ineffective, therefore we get to raise all this stuff about Mr. Sheik. Why was Mr. Whipple ineffective? How was he ineffective? What should he have investigated? How would that have changed what Mr. Whipple then presented? Or if Mr. Whipple was presented, I'm getting tied up too. If Mr. Whipple had presented this information, how would that have changed what Mr. Sheik then did? Right? And particularly in this case, because it's so weird, how is Mr. Whipple ineffective for failing to investigate, but also people who were appointed to assist him who were supposed to be doing investigation, how does that all tie in?
So let me ask you a question, counsel. Doesn't that at some point fall on the trial court, though? Let's assume there was a deficiency in what was alleged about Mr. Whiffle's performance in not commenting or raising claims appropriately about Mr. Sheik. To the extent that petition raised ineffectiveness by Whiffle, did the court have an obligation to conduct some type of evidentiary hearing on that to flesh that out?
No, I don't think so, Justice Herndon, for two reasons. One, because the district court, same as this court, essentially, should be deciding the claims that are put in front of it. And if that claim isn't put forward in the proper manner, then the district court's not under an obligation to create a viable claim out of that. And particularly in this case, where now we're talking about just from the penalty retrial, this would be the second petition from the penalty retrial, counsel's not even required to be effective. So if counsel, because Mr. Whiffle was required to be effective, okay. Second post-conviction counsel is not required.
The one on this case.
Correct, okay. Yes. And so if it was deficiently pled, then that's not something that there's a remedy for. There's no entitlement to the effective assistance of counsel.
Well, what about count 14 of the October 2017 petition, where they go through all of the background evidence that they maintain should have been presented at the second penalty hearing? It's your point that they didn't sufficiently tie that to a defect by Mr. Whiffle in failing to assert Mr. Sheik's failure to present that?
Yes, that sounds correct. I believe that's right.
Okay. Do you have any other answer for why count 14 doesn't put this fairly in play?
So the main point of claim 14 and all of that mitigation evidence, one, they would have to show that Mr. Whiffle was deficient for failing to investigate and then present and challenge. They would have to show that Mr. Whiffle was deficient in not showing that Mr. Sheik was deficient in the penalty retrial for investigating and presenting all of that information. And they would have to show that some impediment external to the defense presented that. And all of that information is like affidavits from family members and maps and geographical information and poverty information about the city that has existed since that was the state of affairs. I mean, those are, at least from what I was looking at in terms of maps, essentially stuff that you can pull up on the internet and create a map for at any point. And maybe Mr. Sheik could have done that. Maybe Mr. Whiffle should have said that, but none of the claims went through that way. And by this point, what Mr. Sheik did is procedurally barred. Unless you get through that Whiffle was deficient, that provides good cause to talk about Sheik, to talk about what happened.
And that's not the way in which 14 is structured.
Not in the 2017 okay. petition, no. They don't start talking about Mr. Whiffle until the reply to our response to the petition.
What about Juror Cunningham and Sheik's failure to ask more questions of her on voir dire?
Is this at the guilt phase that you're talking about?
No, it's at the penalty phase. That's okay. I don't ponder it.
Yeah, I don't think I have a ready answer. My ready answer is just that it should have been fled through the deficient performance of Mr. Whiffle.
Any further questions? All right.
Thank you,
counsel.
Your Honor, just briefly, what I